Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you.
Thanks.
So I don't feel like you'll be very happy by the end of this episode because
Awesome.
I have to start it off with just like a humongous trigger warning. This story is about children, crimes against children, and even children committing crimes against other children. It's really, 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 really heavy. So I kind of feel like maybe you should just sit and maybe not engage as I tell the story.
Yeah. I'll just leave the room. How about that?
That works too.
Is that fair?
Okay. Mary Bell was born in England on May 26, 1957, so she's a Gemini. She was an only child who grew up in Scotswood, which is a district within Newcastle's West End. I have no clue what it's like now, but at least in the 1960s, this is a really, really bad area, like really crime-ridden. It almost bordered on poverty. Police were on a first-name basis with most of the residents, and the particular road that Mary lived on, White House Road, was especially rough. You could find a sex worker every few houses, including Mary's. Betty Bell had given birth to her daughter at only 17 years old, and from the moment she laid eyes on her child, she wanted nothing to do with her. She had no support because Mary's father was always in and out of jail, so she began working as a sex worker that specialized in sadomasochism. With Mary's father being in jail most of the time, it meant no one was there to intervene when Betty began selling her daughter to her clients. Mary later stated this abuse either began when she was 4 years old or her memories of it began at 4 years old. The clients would sometimes sexually assault her. Sometimes they would just beat her. Sometimes they would request that Betty beat her in front of them. And sometimes Betty and the clients would assault Mary together. It was common for Betty to leave little Mary alone for days on end with no care. And once she even left her alone for a month while she traveled to Scotland looking for more work. So between that and being, you know, the 1960s where illogical things like never locking your doors and sending your kids out to play in the street is just the norm, Mary was the epitome of unsupervised. And as a result, she had several near-death experiences. For example, once when Mary was little, she swallowed an entire bottle of sleeping pills. She somehow survived it. And Betty told everyone that the little girl had done it while she was alone and simply didn't know what the pills were. But as an adult, Mary recalled that Betty actually forced her to swallow the pills. On another occasion, Mary fell to the cement sidewalk from a second-story window. She survived the fall but suffered broken bones and head trauma. Betty told everyone that Mary had been playing alone and fell out of the window by accident. But as an adult, Mary said her mother actually pushed her out of the window. Another time, Mary almost drowned in the bath. Betty said Mary was alone and just didn't know how to swim. But again, as an adult, Mary said her mom actually attempted to hold her under the water. By the time Mary is about 10 years old, she's known among her classmates and teachers as an erratic bully who gave everyone the creeps. Mary had dark hair and bright blue eyes, and everyone who knew her said her eyes were especially piercing. She had an unsettling ability to stare at you in a very soul-penetrating kind of way. Mary only had one friend named Norma Bell, who had no relation, and the two were inseparable. The girls had a lot in common in terms of their home life. They both came from abusive environments where they were often left on their own. Throughout her childhood, Mary displayed all of the obvious signs of an abused child, yet none of the adults at school lifted a finger. One time during recess, Mary choked another child to the point that the little girl's face turned red and her lips began changing color. She only stopped when a bigger kid pulled Mary away. Another time, Mary put out a cigarette on a classmate's cheek. When the classmate told the teacher, a guy named Eric Foster, he asked Mary if this was true. Mary matter-of-factly responded yes, and that was the end of it. He didn't investigate what might be going on in her home life and wrote her off as a troubled kid. So, you know, it's obvious to us today that she's displaying all the obvious signs of abuse, but because no one did anything about it back then, Her bullying and physical attacks quickly turned to attempted murder. On May 11th, 1968, 10-year-old Mary and 13-year-old Norma were seen playing with Mary's 3-year-old cousin on the roof of a building, and the little boy fell off and landed on the cement below. He survived but suffered severe injuries. The girls claimed he fell off by accident, and that was that. The next day, on May 12th, a local woman filed a report with the police that Mary had attempted to strangle her young daughter, Pauline. The police questioned Mary and Norma, but nothing came of it. And that may be because at the time, little Pauline was too afraid to tell the whole story. What she's recounted as an adult goes like this. Pauline was playing in a sandpit when Norma pinned her down, and then Mary grabbed Pauline by the neck and squeezed as hard as she could. Pauline opened her mouth and gasped for air. Mary continued to strangle her with one hand and, using the other hand, poured sand into Pauline's open mouth. Norma seemed surprised at this and jumped up, which allowed Pauline enough time to wiggle away from Mary's grip, and she promptly ran home. After she ran away, Mary attempted to repeat the same scenario with two other little girls who were playing in the sandpit. They reported that Norma pinned them down while Mary tried to strangle them and shove sand in their mouths. Both of those girls managed to get away too. Later that day, Mary attempted to strangle Norma's older sister, only stopping when Norma's father walked in and had to pry Mary's fingers off of the girl's neck. 13 days later, on May 25th, the day before Mary's 11th birthday, a 4-year-old named Martin Brown was found dead in a derelict home. He had been found sprawled out, almost as if he were on a cross, and his little body was covered with trash and debris. He didn't have any visible injuries other than a tiny trickle of blood by his mouth. After interviewing witnesses and investigating the home, police had a theory. The former owners had left a bottle of pills, which the police referred to as tablets, and because no one actually witnessed his death, and he had no obvious injuries, and the bottle was almost emptied and found a few inches from him, they assumed that he ingested the pills and died of an overdose. However, his autopsy later revealed that he had no pills in his system, so his death was ruled an accident caused by the dangerous conditions of the derelict home. This area that he had died in, a place called Rat Alley, was in the process of being demolished as a way to, like, eradicate the slums. So it was common for the neighborhood kids to play in these empty homes. But the local government was demolishing these buildings at a snail's pace and not adequately removing debris. So after Martin's death, a march was held to protest the dangers that this inflicted on the community. And one of the little kids at the front of the march, carrying part of the banner, was none other than Mary Bell. Martin's mother, June, said that when she was alerted that he'd been in an accident, she dropped everything and ran to him. She remembers he was cold to the touch as they loaded him into the ambulance, and she couldn't comprehend that he was dead. So she ripped her sweater off and wrapped it around him to try to warm him up. She said that Martin was tall for his age and always getting into mischief. She said one time he decided that he wanted a swimming pool in his room, so he filled a drawer with water and ended up flooding the whole place. This was her baby, and she was devastated to lose him. His name was Martin, and everyone knew this. But because he died in this area called Rat Alley, the newspapers began referring to him as Rat Alley Boy. June said that realizing their community would now forever associate the word rat with her child made an already unbearable pain even worse. 2 days after Martin's death, police responded to a report of a break-in at a nursery school in Scottswood. Someone had broken in and completely trashed the place. Amongst the mess, they found a few notes with misspelled scribbles on them. They read, "I murder so that I may come back," and "fuck off, we murder, watch out." And on another, "we did murder Martin Brown." Police dismissed this as a prank because it was obvious that a child had written the notes and they had already announced that his death was an accident. June's sister babysat a lot of the neighborhood kids, Mary and Norma included. A few days after Martin's death, June was at her sister's, and she was so touched when little Mary and Norma asked her, "How are you feeling? Are you missing him?" And she thought to herself, like, how nice is it that they care how I feel? It's so sweet. But a couple of days later, while she was getting ready for Martin's funeral, June heard a knock at her door and opened it to find Mary and Norma. The girls asked if they could see Martin. June was surprised, but assumed that, you know, they were just young and confused about what death meant and wanted Martin to come out to play. So she reminded them that Martin was gone and he would not be coming back. To which Mary excitedly responded, "I know. We want to see him in his coffin." Fast forward to 2 months later, on Wednesday, July 31st, 1968. A 3-year-old boy named Brian Howe was amongst the crowd of unsupervised kids gathering to watch more buildings get demolished in Rat Alley. When Brian didn't come home for dinner that night, his dad went straight to the police and reported him missing. But then sadly, around 11 p.m., someone found Brian's body in a field. He was laid out in the same manner that Martin had been, as though he was on a cross. Someone had snipped off a bunch of his hair with scissors and laid it out around him. He was partially nude and had many lacerations up and down his legs. His penis had been severely mutilated, and someone had carved the initial N into his stomach, but then changed it into an M. His cause of death was strangulation, and they believe all of the cuts and mutilation happened post-mortem. Police suspected that someone very young had killed him. They described his cuts as being gentle and almost playful, like someone wasn't maliciously stabbing him, but more like experimenting. Even though Martin Brown's case was already closed, they found the similarities between the two scenes so similar that they reopened Martin's case, and they made the shocking announcement to the public that not only did they believe both boys had been murdered, but that they suspected the murderer was a child. This was obviously upsetting to everyone, because who would have expected that? Now everyone has to look at their kids and wonder if they've been sending them out to play with a murderer. Or worse, is my kid a murderer? Police noted that every press conference they held, without fail, the same little blue-eyed, dark-haired girl would show up and listen intently at the very front of the crowd. So while all of the parents are obviously freaked out, police are shocked to discover that most of the neighborhood kids already knew who did it. Mary had started to brag to the other kids that she and Norma had recently strangled a little boy and gotten away with it. But what Mary and Norma did not know is that a 9-year-old boy witnessed them killing Brian Howe. He told police that he saw Mary and Norma approach Brian in the crowd of kids watching the demolition, and then saw the three of them walking towards an empty field. Not long after this, the little boy also leaves the crowd and makes his way towards the general area he saw the kids go. Mary, Norma, and little Brian were alone in the field, and this 9-year-old saw Mary strangle Brian. Then he saw her pull out something sharp and do something to Brian's body with it. Police brought Mary in for questioning, and they said the experience was bizarre and unsettling. She was 10 years old, yet very sophisticated in how she handled the interview. It was almost as if she knew all the questions that they planned to ask, and most of the time she'd answer it before they even finished speaking. Then she would go on to answer the next 4 or 5 questions that they planned to ask next. Mary admitted to police that, quote, "I like to hurt people in little things that can't fight back." But she denied killing anyone. Mary was then interviewed by a child psychiatrist named Dr. Monica Robathan, who said that she was one of the toughest kids she'd ever sat with. Mary only opened up when talking about her friendship with Norma, and in reference to the day that Brian died, she said, quote, "Norma and I had such a laugh that day." Mary then went on to admit that she and Norma did in fact break into the nursery school, and they did write those notes that police found, but she insisted it was just for fun. Actually, what she called it was just for a giggle. When Norma was questioned, she cracked immediately and told police that while she wasn't present for Martin's murder, Mary had bragged that she had killed him and gotten away with it. She then admitted that she and Mary killed Brian together. She showed them the exact location he was found and even the position that they left his body in. And then she handed over the scissors that they used to mutilate him. She told police that Mary approached both boys and told them that their necks were sore, so she was going to massage them. She would then slowly start to squeeze tighter until they stopped moving. Mary and Norma are both arrested and charged with the murder of Brian Howe. And remember that teacher who asked Mary about putting a cigarette out on another little kid? After her arrest, he decided to go through all of her schoolwork to see if she had said anything about the crimes. And he was astonished to find that she had in fact written about them pretty extensively and drawn an incriminating picture. I mean, this dude, Eric, was like clearly terrible at his job. I don't know what he was doing all day in school. Anyways, he finds that 2 days after Martin's body was found, Mary wrote on one of her school books the words, "Boy found dead in old house." She then drew a picture of a little kid laid out in the same position that Martin had been found. And next to his head, she wrote the word tablets. Now that little detail is a big deal because the discovery of the tablets near his body and the subsequent theory that Martin had died of an overdose was never made public. So for the police, this was the most incriminating piece of evidence linking Mary to Martin's death. Mary and Norma's trial lasted only 9 days. Every adult who interacted with or observed the girls in the courtroom stated that it was evident neither one understood what was going on and didn't comprehend the severity of what they were being accused of. The jurors later stated that watching Mary on the stand was unsettling. She was so little, and it was hard to fathom that she would be involved in any type of crime, much less something this serious. But the differences between the two girls was quite stark. Mary was said to be very bright and sharp. She was very articulate and capable of responding to questions from everyone in a straightforward, very quick-witted manner. And Norma, on the other hand, she was very shy and insecure, and every adult involved in the case has repeatedly stated that she wasn't very bright. It was clear that Mary was the leader and Norma was the follower. Mary's lawyer said that she acted like any typical 11-year-old, and her focus wasn't on the future or the outcome of the trial. She wondered how her dog was doing back home, and she asked several times if her mom would visit soon. She also didn't sleep most nights. She would get up to go to the bathroom multiple times because she was afraid that she would get in trouble for wetting the bed in her cell. The verdict was highly dependent on the psychiatrist who recalled to assess both of the girls. And they concluded that Mary did not possess the same emotions that other children her age possessed. They observed that Mary didn't seem to feel remorse or anxiety, and they went so far as to say that she displayed the classic signs of a psychopath, whereas Norma literally did anything that Mary told her to do. The trial concluded with 13-year-old Norma Bell acquitted on the grounds that she was simple-minded and had been dominated by Mary. 11-year-old Mary Bell was convicted of manslaughter. Mary didn't know what the conviction meant, and when they walked her out of the courtroom, she believed that they were sending her to the gallows. Mary was sentenced to something called detained to Her Majesty's pleasure, which is a sentencing that is typically applied to very young offenders for serious crimes they've committed and are likely to commit again in the future. So it basically means the person gets an indefinite amount of time in prison until it's determined that the person is safe to be released, which is sometimes never. But it's a more appropriate sentence for someone very young like Mary, rather than sentencing her to a more traditional thing like life in prison. According to Wikipedia, prisoners held at Her Majesty's pleasure are frequently reviewed to determine whether their sentence can be deemed complete. Martin's mother, June, felt that this sentencing was justice. She said that she hated those two little girls, and had she been given the opportunity to get her hands on them, she would have found herself in court the following week. And after the sentencing, Mary said, quote, "Brian Howe had no mother, so he won't be missed. If I was a judge and I had an 11-year-old who had done this, I'd give her 18 months. Murder isn't that bad. We all die sometime anyway." Not surprisingly, after the trial, Mary's mother, Betty, sold her story to whoever would listen, and she would often sell what she claimed were letters and poems that Mary sent her from jail. One of the letters read in part, "Please, Mom, put my tiny mind at ease. Tell judge and jury on your knees. They will listen to your cries of pleas. The guilty one is you, not me. I'm sorry it has to be this way. We'll both cry and you will go away. Tell them you are guilty, please. So then, Mom, I'll be free. Mary went on to spend 12 years incarcerated, with the first 6 years spent at a sort of, like, juvie of sorts. At this facility, Mary was the only girl among 22 boys. There were rumors that she experienced sexual harassment and assault, but I couldn't find confirmation of that. The psychologist and the psychiatrist who treated Mary during her adolescence stated that she never seemed remorseful of the murders. In fact, she was very dismissive of the topic, as if the murders weren't relevant to her. In 1977, she was transferred to an adult women's prison, and she briefly escaped, but was found and taken into custody within a day. In 1980, a judge deemed 23-year-old Mary officially rehabilitated and no longer considered a threat to society, so she was released. By British law, she was offered anonymity and a new identity, which she accepted. 4 years later, on Mary's birthday, a day after the anniversary of Martin Brown's murder, she gave birth to a daughter. At some point in her adult life, Mary decided to write a memoir, something that caused public outrage because she stood to profit off of it. According to Wikipedia, Tony Blair's government attempted to find a legal means to prevent its publication on the grounds that a criminal should not profit from his or her crimes. But the attempt was unsuccessful, and Mary ultimately made about $70,000. Sharon Richardson, the sister of Mary's first victim, Martin Brown, said in an interview that she didn't necessarily think about Mary very much prior to the book release. She said that she and her family didn't go looking for Mary when she was released from prison, and they weren't forcing her into the public eye. She said Mary chose to bring herself back into the public eye by writing the book, and she forced the victims' families to talk about it as a result. And on the topic of Mary profiting off the book, Sharon said, quote, "When she received that money, she received it under an assumed name, not Mary Bell. And I think she gave up her right to anonymity the day that she received her money. Anonymity is supposed to work for the rehabilitation of offenders and to give them a new start in life. She didn't take that chance for a new start in life because she decided to write that book and profit off that book." And I want to be really clear, I did not read the book. I just used the book reviews as reference. Mary wrote about her childhood and stated that her and Norma's home lives were so full of pain and violence that they really bonded over a fantasy of escaping it one day. They created alter egos and used to egg each other on about who could do the naughtiest things. At the time of the murders, Mary said she remembers thinking, "I didn't mean to kill him forever." In 2009, it was reported that Mary had become a grandmother, and she successfully got lifetime anonymity for her, her daughter, and her grandchild. Martin's mother, June, said that she hopes that every time Mary looks at her grandchild, she remembers that she robbed June of ever seeing grandchildren from Martin. And that is the story of Mary Bell.
Did you ever watch the movie Bad Seed?
Oh, like from the 50s?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was this girl in my school that reminded me of her, or reminded my mom of her. Oh. And she's like, "You need to watch the movie The Bad Seed."
Yeah.
You watched it. And it was, it's not the whole reason I'm scared of kids, but it's a little bit.
Yeah. And like, I can totally, I know that like for you, somebody who like doesn't want to have children anyways, you then hear about a story like this and it's horrifying.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, she was victimized. She wasn't
absolutely.
Just, you know, she wasn't a bad seed.
No,
so that's what's
yeah.
so sad about it. And, you know, what Mary did to the families of Martin and Brian is irreparable, and she should not have been able to profit off of it, period. And knowing that she has the opportunity to live out the rest of her natural days, you know, experiencing the world, having a child and relationships, becoming a grandparent, doing things like having friends or having a job or sitting in traffic, I mean, all the mundane and beautiful things in life, it's horrible knowing that she gets a chance to experience all of that when her victims did not. But then on the other hand, I also think that hearing her story is insightful. It's just that it's unfortunate that it was tainted by her profiting off of it. because we all know that most people who commit murder or abuse others, they were likely victimized first. And Mary Bell committed heinous cruelty, but she was also an innocent child who only knew heinous cruelty.
That's very true.
I mean, a 10-year-old is not fully developed. They're still learning right from wrong and safe versus dangerous and kind versus mean and so forth. And their capacity to understand consequences is still developing. Their capacity to process emotions is still developing. And, you know, any child's environment and the adults in it literally mold the child's idea of normal. Mm-hmm. So if all they experience is abuse, then that is what becomes normal to them. Well, and I don't say any of that in defense of Mary. It's just a matter of fact.
It's like a matter of empathy, too. Like, yeah. Understanding how it happened.
Yeah, because you have to have compassion for the little innocent girl who endured unspeakable acts, who had no one to look out for her.
And it's also like when you grow up in a certain environment, we pick up the mannerisms of our parents and our siblings.
Yeah.
We become like their mini-me's in certain ways.
Yeah.
The same thing goes to violence. And like the scale of good and bad becomes really skewed when the people that you look up to and birth to are the ones inflicting some of that.
Yeah, exactly. Or inflicting in any way, really.
Of course.
And so, I mean, I think that you have to have compassion for her while also it's okay to hate her for what she did and hate what she did. But one emotion doesn't erase the other. They can coexist.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for telling me that story, and telling all of us that story.
Yeah, you and everyone.
Yeah, just me.
Well, thank you for listening.
Anytime. Bye. Bye. Love you.
Love you. Yeah, I love you.
I love you, Ashley.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/Shorty's Podcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anna Katharina.